Welcome to this episode of the podcast by the Institute of Economic Affairs. My name is Mark Littlewood. I'm the Director General here. And in this podcast, I am delighted to be joined by Dominic Frisby to discuss his latest book on tax called Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future. Dominic is a comedian, presenter, actor, general all-round polymath. He's the resident MC at London's oldest comedy venue, and he often makes hilarious videos for his YouTube channel. Recent videos on his channel include a comedy album entitled Libertarian Love Songs, which includes such hits as F the Government, the National Anthem of Libertaria, of course, both the standard and full choir version, and perhaps most famously of all, 17 Million Something Offs, a song about Brexit. When Dominic's not creating material to make us laugh, he is also a financial writer, presumably to make us cry. He's a Money Week contributor. He's written books on finance and economics. And in his most recent book, the subject of our discussion today, Dominic undertakes the small task of writing about the entire history of taxation and the human race. But as taxes are basically as old as civilization itself, it turns out there is quite a lot for him to get through. But luckily, he reckons it's his best book yet. Dominic, thanks very much for joining us at the IEA.
Thanks very much for having me, Mark, and thanks very much for that introduction.
So let's kick off. Give me, if you can, a brief overview of this book, which kind of begins at the dawn of time and takes us up to the present day. But what's the theme that runs through all of its chapters and passages?
Well, if you look at... I'm sure you're a great fan of the zombie movie.
Of course.
And as we're in the middle of a zombie outbreak, coronavirus, there's always this idea in a zombie movie of the zero patient or patient zero. And this is the virus, where the virus started, where the illness started, the illness that's going to destroy mankind. But if our hero can get to the zero patient, either he can kill the zero patient and thereby destroy the zombie virus, or the zero patient will have the antidote with which he can save mankind. And I used to think, and I still do to an extent, that if we are to fix society, the zero patient is our system of money. We need to fix our system of money. But I've now come around to the idea that as important, if not more important than our system of money, is our system of tax. And that is the zero patient. If we want to fix the world, if a politician
Which
wants to
Which is bringing
change the
about
world,
a metaphorical zombie apocalypse, in your mind.
Well, it is. It's created all zombie economies and zombie workers and all the rest of it. And as you said, there's never been a civilization without taxation. The first taxes were levied in ancient Mesopotamia. Tithes, some form of the tithe. But it's likely that this sense of duty to the greater collective existed in the hunter-gatherer societies that predated civilization. So it's part of us, and as you know, it's said to be Benjamin Franklin who coined the phrase that death and taxes are the two inevitabilities. Actually, the phrase goes back to a 17th century early 18th century farce called The Cobbler of Preston. But anyway, you know, death and taxes are inevitable.
Okay.
But there are good taxes and there are bad taxes.
Okay, so it's not all about taxes making us into zombies then, but what is the sort of rough common thread of all of these taxes from, I don't know, ancient Greece to Civil War America to the British Empire to the modern day? What's the common thread in them that this obligation to contribute to the collective, and why are you generally treating it as a bad thing rather than a good thing?
Well, if I was to go full hardcore anarcho-capitalist, I would say all taxes are bad and there should be zero taxes. But the evidence of history is that even in, you know, the most enlightened societies in history, which you might say was ancient Athens or late 19th century Britain or America shortly after the revolution and so on, the evidence is there's always some taxes of one kind or another. But the beauty of ancient Greece is that they were voluntary. Taxes were voluntary. And this is why a lot of people have a lot of people of an anarcho-capitalist mindset have dislike taxes, because they're forced upon you, they're imposed on you. But just coming back to this idea of, you know, going all the way back through history, I used to do a sort of this book started off as an Edinburgh show, and I used to do a sort of game with the audience, and I would try and get them. Once you start looking at the world through the prism of taxation, so much becomes clear why things are as they are, why events in the past happen in the way they did, why things in the future will turn out in a certain way. Because you design a society the way that you tax it, but there's an untold tax story behind almost every great event in history. So I would get the audience to shout out, you know, events from history, and a really common one was the birth of Christ. Well, Mary and Joseph were in Bethlehem to pay taxes. That's the only reason that they were there. And had Augustus Caesar not levied that tax, they wouldn't have been in Bethlehem, and Christianity could never have evolved in the way that it did. Another one is, you know, the first men on the moon. Well, NASA was a tax-funded operation. Another one would be the First World War or the Second World War or any war. And then, but every single war in history, every single one, was funded by some kind of tax. And tax not necessarily just of money. You know, tax was often paid in kind, in labour, in produce, and so on. And, you know, you can, if you don't have taxes, you cannot have war. And of course, wars are often funded by debt, and often, you know, wars were paid for by plundering the losing side after the event. You conquer and then you plunder and then you tax. But so there's this odd relationship between tax and war, and every revolution in history is normally some kind of rising up against some kind of injustice perpetrated by the tax system. And in fact, tax is control. And even like today, you know, Lebanon today, or the Gilets Jaunes in France today, but, you know, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, even the English Civil War was basically a war over who collected tax, who kept the taxes, Parliament or the Crown. And even, you know, Boudica or Boadicea or Spartacus, they were all one way or another tax rebels. Robin Hood, of course, even though when it's not in, you know, even though he's a legend, it's not entirely sure he actually existed. But legends normally start off with some kind of event, and then it becomes history, and then it becomes myth, and then it becomes legend. But so, you know, and every revolution, of course, is about overthrowing the rulers and changing who the person, you know, tax is power. He who collects, if a government or a king or an emperor loses their tax revenue, they lose their power. And so this, once you start looking at the world like this, you suddenly realize, you know, that taxation in its, you know, economics, taxation is taught as a sort of subset of economics, isn't it? And but taxation should be a subject in itself.
Of history.
Well, I mean, alongside history and economics and science.
Because what I found really fascinating about your book, and it did change the way I looked at taxation, you know, I kind of look at taxation as a kind of, I roll my eyes a bit and it's a bit of a burden and I don't really trust the government to spend the money that well. But I don't consider it, I've never really considered it to be a particularly formative part of what's actually happening. It's just sort of a chunk taken out of my paycheck, or a levy placed on a pint of beer that I buy, or you know, an item I buy in a shop. But what you're seem determined to point out here is it isn't that. It's not just a little bit of sort of slicing off the top so the rulers can have it. It actually changes and forms the major events of history.
It's the whole system. It's everything. That's why I keep going on about it being the zero patient. And, you know, I think a lot of politicians go into power and they get very frustrated that their hands are pretty tied and there's not that much they can actually do. But the one thing they can do is fix tax. And you think all the effort, all the political effort that went into stopping Brexit, imagine if that had gone into
sorting
reforming
out the
taxes.
So give me some of the examples. Give me just two or three sort of standout examples. I mean, either of the worst tax ever, or a tax that was just considered to try and raise a little bit of money to try and, I don't know, fight a war, build a bridge, but ended up causing you know, unintended consequences that sort of spiraled way beyond the intentions, imaginations, dreams, or nightmares of the person forming the tax.
There's no end of them. But the first example I use in the book is the window tax.
That's, of course, where the book derives its name from.
Daylight robbery, precisely. Although that, like, they, when they were arguing about the window tax in Parliament in the 1850s and 1860s, the legend has it MPs cried out daylight robbery. But it's disputed that that's the origin of the phrase. But nevertheless, And the phrase first appeared in print in like 1917 in a
right.
in a play called Hobson's Choice, maybe a bit earlier than 1917. But anyway, the idea is that that phrase goes back to the window tax. And, you know, the window tax was introduced in the 1690s. And what had happened is that William and Mary were the new monarchs. And William was, of course, Dutch. And Mary was a Catholic. She was James II's sister. And so the new monarchs needed to be ingratiated with the newly conquered
They
people.
Wanted an opinion poll bounce, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so what they did to ingratiate the new monarchs with the people is in the English Bill of Rights in 1688, 1689, after the Glorious Revolution, they abolished hearth taxes, or hearth money it was called. Now, the hearth money was a bit, in a way, it was a bit like the BBC licence fee, in that twice a year, tax inspectors would demand entry into your house.
And see how many fireplaces you've got.
To count the number of fireplaces. And this was considered a violation of the Englishman's sacred privacy. And the tax used to be paid to the church. It was called smoke farthings at one stage. It was a sort of Norman thing, probably even predated Normans. But in at some point during the English Civil War, the taxes started to be paid to the crown. And the English hated this tax. And so to ingratiate themselves, William and Mary got rid of hearth money. But the problem was, 5 or 6 years later, hearth money was the government's biggest source of revenue. And they had no money. And so they were looking around, how can we raise money? We've got a war in France to fight. There was monetary crisis going on at the time. That's why the Bank of England was formed. There's all sorts of problems. And so they imposed a window tax, and the infrastructure was already there to collect it from hearth money. But the beauty of the window tax is that a tax collector could walk past somebody's house, count the number of windows. Without having to enter. So there was no interaction.
And it was sort of considered fair, right, that the number of windows you had is going to be broadly in line with how big your property and how rich you are. Yeah, that's the concept.
But of course, that was the concept. But of course, as Adam Smith showed, that you could have a house with 20 windows in the middle of nowhere in the country.
Yep.
And you could have a house with just one window, you know, in zone one.
Yeah, as they called it back in the day. Yeah.
And so there was an inconsistency. But anyway, that was the idea. Mm-hmm. And there's this weird cycle with a tax, is that they're always introduced on a temporary basis, normally as a result of some kind of crisis, usually a war. So in the case of, I think it was it the 8 Years' War that was going on in the 1690s? I forget. But anyway, that was why it was imposed. It was imposed on a temporary basis, and the amounts payable were low at first. But over time, they gradually crept up. And the tax had all sorts of unintended consequences. One is it guided architecture. In Britain for the next, and even as we sit here in the IEA,
how do you build a nice house with as few as possible windows?
And right. But also they would like notches, so if you paid, if it was like below 8 windows, you paid a certain tax above 8 windows,
like cliff edge effects kind of thing, right?
So houses were always built with 7 windows or whatever, just below the notch. And in fact, if you look at this building here in the IEA building, you'll see that the building was built with the windows bricked in. And the reason that they were built with the windows bricked in is it gave the owner the option to knock through and put in a window if he wanted to and pay the extra tax.
Right, or if the tax rates changed at some point in the future,
exactly.
You could
so
then...
You have all these houses built with the windows bricked in, and this very building being an example. But so it informed the way that cities looked, and John Mill called it it was the cause of a deformity in architecture, he called it. But the biggest unintended consequence of all was that it made people ill. And all the damped, cramped, windowless dwellings, you know, exacerbated all the diseases, cholera, typhus, and so on.
You're getting no light, no fresh air.
Yeah, no light, no fresh air. And you know, of course, there was no electricity then. There wasn't even gas lighting then. It was rush lights and tallow candles and things like that. So it was a huge sacrifice. And it ended up being the poor who suffered the most because of it, because landlords on whom the tax fell simply either boarded up the buildings or they built new buildings with no windows at all those tenement buildings, and the poor paid the price. And there was all sorts of campaigns to get rid of it. Pamphlets were handed out, songs were sung, Charles Dickens wrote endlessly, the Lancet was campaigning against it, and still the tax went on. And it was 170 years the tax lasted. It wasn't until the early 1860s, I think, that they got rid of it. And it was only because of the imposition of income tax. The income tax was originally imposed in the Napoleonic Wars, but they abandoned it after the war. And then Sir Robert Peel brought it back. But in bringing it back, he got rid of something like 500 petty taxes.
Right.
But one of the ones he didn't get rid of was window tax. But the fact that government was now levying income tax, which, by the way, was introduced on a temporary basis until debts were cleared and then we get rid of it, but they never got rid of it. And it was only because of window tax, income tax, that they were finally able to get rid of window tax. But, you know, if you'd said to William and Mary, yes, this tax will ingratiate yourself with the new with the people, but it is going to kill hundreds of people, thousands, if not, you know, I'm not sure they would have imposed it. Maybe they would. People were a bit more ruthless in those days. There was less of a premium on human life. But talk about unintended consequences.
Sure. And so do you sort of see this this dash through history that you make in this book? Are we permanently sort of looking at a kind of class struggle, if you will? There's the sort of, there's the poor, the downtrodden, or the average Joe, who in this instance is, you know, suddenly for tax reasons no longer getting light or air and therefore dying of whatever illness. Or in the United States of America, there's a whole argument brews up around tea. I mean, do you see history as being this kind of continual battle between the oppressed, the people being obliged to pay taxes of one form or another, and the oppressor, whether that's William and Mary or, you know, modern day social democratic governments? Is that the right way to view all of these?
I think it's certainly a way of looking at history. And there's this, you know, there's this constant battle by leaders trying to, you know, as the saying goes, to pluck the goose so as to obtain the most amount of feathers with the least possible hissing. That was Louis XV's tax advisor who came up with that great line. And you know that, you know, VAT, for example, it's not a progressive tax. It hurts the poor more than it hurts the rich because everyone pays the same rate. But it's proved a brilliant tax from the point of view of the tax collector because it can be deducted at source. You can force, you know, companies have to pay it. And it's quite an easy and a simple tax collect. So there's this eternal dance with the taxpayer who's trying to pay as little as possible and keep what he earns. And then there's the tax collector who's trying to, you know, own as much of the labour, the produce, the profit of the people as possible. By the way, I just was reading, I've just stumbled across this old tax, in the, which I sort of cover in the book a little bit, but I found out, I wish I knew this when I written the book, but there was one of the things I did in the Edinburgh show is I would try and get the audience to shout out places, one area of our life that doesn't involve taxation in some way. So I'll do that game with you. What's one area of our life that
having sex?
Having sex is about the only one. Although the bed you do it on is of course
VAT.
Taxed.
Yeah.
VAT on the bed. But the only area, like, and breathing is another. And although, of course, the window tax, you know,
yeah, effectively was a tax.
You know, Charles Dickens said the line, you know, as free as air. There's no such thing as free as air anymore because of the window tax.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, bodily function is one of the few areas. I remember one Australian bloke, when I said that question, shouted out, masturbating in a very kind of gruff Australian accent. And then somebody else in the audience went, yeah, but tissues are taxed.
Right.
But the only, one of the few areas is, you know, bodily functions are one of the hardest things to tax. But in ancient Rome, Nero enacted a urine tax. Now, urine was used in ancient Rome for tanning and laundering, but also to brush your teeth. And pots would be left at convenient locations all around the city for the ordinary working man to pee in. And then collectors would go around and collect the urine afterwards. And I think they were using the ammonia, basically. Mm-hmm. It's very efficient, really, when you think about it. And obviously, upper class urine, you know, came through their latrines and it came that way. But for some bizarre reason, Portuguese urine was the most prized urine by ancient Romans. Portuguese urine was believed to be of better quality.
A true delicacy.
A true delicacy. And so there was this huge premium on Portuguese urine. But anyway, by one way or another, you know, it was actually imported. Anyway, but, you know, urine became big business. Right. And so Nero levied his urine tax. And then Vespasian, who was, I think, two or three after Nero, kept it going. And he was criticised for this urine tax. And he famously held up a gold coin and said, meaning to signify his tax revenue and said, the money is clean.
Well, that's, but these are fascinating, all these stories, which you can look at Nero's Rome, and you can sort of see echoes in what happens today. But what's interesting about your book, which perhaps we just don't think about when we're looking through our pay slips and how much we tax on income or on VAT when we make purchases, is it's really sort of World War One where you get this ratchet effect, yeah. Right? So we can look back at the horrors of a window tax, say, but obviously we're looking at a country which is impoverished by today's standards, and actually tax takers a total proportion of national income, admittedly a much lower national income, mm-hmm. quite low. Right.
Yeah.
So we don't, you know, I mean, we're at what, you know, 35-40% of all income is taxed typically in the Western world now. It was way lower than that, wasn't it, back in the day?
Well,
so albeit in much poorer societies, but as a proportion, it wasn't at that sort of level.
Yeah,
am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. In 1900, most of Western Europe, and Western Europe was the leading civilization in the world at that time, at the turn of the 20th century, tax was roughly 10% of GDP. And you look at the great societies in history, the societies that are the most innovative, the most inventive, they lead the world in science, they lead the world in art, they lead the world in whatever. And they tend to be militarily the strongest as well. They are almost always, at least initially, low tax mm-hmm. regimes. And so there's this relationship between tax and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
The more tax, the more of your labor that is owned, the less free you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the more of your profit or produce that is taken that is not yours to keep, the less free you are. And so, at the one extreme, you have, you know, England in 1900 or the USA in 1900 or even ancient Greece. And then at the other extreme, you have, you know, North Korea, where all of your labour and your produce
taxed,
and your profits, it's not so much taxed as owned.
Owned, yeah, yeah.
Owned. And yeah. The Soviet Union was at about 75%. They reckon there was about 25% of GDP was black market. And here we are today, we're at around about 40-45%. But if you factor in inflation, which in itself is, you know, taxation without legislation, as Milton Friedman said, and the debasement of currency is one highly, and quantitative easing, of course, is, you know, I would define that as inflation in the sense that it is inflating the money supply. And it's a
so the state is making our cash holdings worth less
yeah.
with each
it's
passing.
It's transferring
value.
The value
yeah.
of your cash to the state.
Yeah.
By debasing money. And I mean, that's one of the ways that government is going to deal with their debt problem is to inflate.
The perfect stealth tax.
Yeah, it is the ultimate stealth tax, exactly. And debt, of course, is a tax on the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although all the modern monetary theorists would probably disagree with that, but it is. At a certain point, the debt, you know, you might be paying the debt back with devalued money, mm-hmm, but, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. anyway. So there's this measure of freedom. So I actually think it's what we pay into. I mean, Tax Freedom Day in the UK occurs when? Early June. But really, if you add inflation and debt, it's later. It's
but it's
later.
Not just freedom, right? You're also saying, I mean, you might value freedom intrinsically, that, you know, we want to live in a free society. But there's also, if you like, tangible material benefits. These low tax areas produce more innovation, more technology, grow faster, relieve poverty faster, achieve wealth more
yeah.
rapidly.
Well, the example I use is Hong Kong. And, you know, Hong Kong in the second half of the 20th century and Singapore were incredible societies from the point of view of economic growth. At the end of the Second World War, Hong Kong was on a par on a per capita basis with much of Africa. And then, you know, taxes never exceeded 15% of GDP. And, you know, it had in its financial controller a chap called Cowperthwaite, who was an acolyte of Adam Smith's. And it just had this incredible growth, and not just growth in its economy, but people moved to Hong Kong quite voluntarily, and the government didn't provide a lot of basic services, housing aside. And, you know, now you look at Hong Kong, and it has the best education in the world, it has the best transport system in the world, in terms of its education, it's regularly comes out first. It's in the healthcare index, I think it ranks first as well.
Its GDP per capita is now in advance of Western
yeah,
Europe
like
rather
twice,
than...
It's almost twice the UK's now. And it was like a fifth of the UK's at the turn of mm-hmm. the 20th century. And Hong Kong didn't follow the same Keynesian policies as Western Europe did. And Cowperthwaite said, Keynes was not writing with us in mind.
Right.
And then just dismissed the whole thing. And so, so there is definitely evidence that low taxes lead to greater prosperity. And Cowperthwaite always used to say the revenue will make its way to the exchequer eventually. And this was something that Laffer observed, that, you know, low taxes are actually, government revenue can actually increase with lower rates of tax. But Laffer quite freely says, you know, this goes all the way back to early Islam, which presumed the same policy. People can't understand how Islam expanded so quickly in the 7th century. Well, you know, it was conquering territories, either Byzantine or Roman territories or Sasanian empires that were heavily, heavily taxed. And so the people in those countries were glad for a new ruler to come in and tax them less.
Right.
And the Islamic conquerors said, if you convert to Islam, you don't have to pay the poll tax. And if you don't want to convert to Islam, that's fine. You've got to pay the poll tax. And if you don't pay the poll tax, you die. So it was death taxes or Islam.
Yes, fairly.
And everyone chose Islam.
Fairly clear Islam. List of incentives there. Yeah.
And Islam became one of the fastest growing empires ever.
This is fascinating. So I've got two questions. Firstly, if you like... why doesn't the Hong Kong experiment, or even these, less proximate in historical terms experiments, why isn't it therefore accepted wisdom in the UK or the Western world that we should get taxes down to about 15% of GDP? You're saying basically the empirical evidence is there. If you want to be rich, if you want poverty to be relieved, if you want good transport systems, good health systems and innovation, it should be about 15% in rough terms. So why isn't that the sort of driving, why aren't we getting there? I mean, if that's what the evidence shows. And why was it in particular, what impact did particularly the First World War have on sort of ratcheting us up to a level which we then never got back down to? The previous wars, we're going to tax you for the war, we win the war or we lose the war, but if we win the war, then we sort of return to the, you know, peaceful status. That doesn't seem to happen in the 20th century, right? We get this ratchet effect and then stay at the top.
Well, there are two questions there, but let's deal with the second question first, which is this thing, the IFS calls it the ratchet effect, where... leaders who try and impose new taxes in times of peace usually goes very badly wrong for them, even if the tax is perhaps quite a good tax.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, the Mansion tax badly backfired on Miliband. He wasn't technically a leader. George Osborne's tampon taxes and the Greggs thing backfired on him. Margaret Thatcher, of course, the poll tax. There's many examples throughout history of leaders. You need some kind of national emergency to impose new taxes. And so what happened in World War II in the United States is that ordinary Americans didn't pay income tax until 1942 Revenue Act, and suddenly ordinary Americans are paying income tax for the very first time. And it was framed as their patriotic duty. And then the same thing happened in World War I. Income tax had been around in the UK for quite a long time, but again, ordinary English people, British people, didn't pay it until the war, and then tax rates suddenly went up. There were more women in the workforce, of course, because the men were all away fighting. They were paying tax. And by the way, another argument thing that gets thrown at me, women's suffrage. What's the relationship between women's suffrage and taxation? Well, the fact that women were now paying taxes in World War One was a major justification
for giving
in the argument
women the
at
vote.
The time that they should have the vote. If we're paying taxes, we should have the vote. And quite right too. But what happens after the war is taxes never go back to the level, or they didn't go back to the level they were before
the
crisis.
But that's
the
bit that confuses me. Why wasn't VE Day or VJ Day, you know, the let's cut income tax day? Hurrah! You know,
because
this patriotic duty we've had, we're now discharged.
There's several reasons for that. Firstly, is there's all sorts of obligations to pay after the war. You know, the government's got to look after its wounded. Mm-hmm. It's got a major infrastructure projects to build all the buildings that have been bombed. It's got welfare to provide. It's incurred all sorts of obligations. So it's partly all the new obligations that it has. But it's partly, it's control. It's, we've got this control now. Why would we hand this power back? So it literally is that dynamic, particularly after World War II and you know, the welfare state that was promised and National Health Service and all these things, they've got to be paid for. So I do think it's a control thing. And so to come back to your... I said that every war is paid for by taxes, but there's this relationship where tax makes war possible, but war makes tax possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, we wonder how the state has grown so big and it's this monster. Well, it goes back to those two world wars.
And what's your explanation? And why aren't the people, now we do have, you know, the democratic vote, men and women can all vote, why aren't people saying, well, actually, I've had enough of this, I'm going to vote for candidates or a party that are going to pledge halving tax, for sake of argument?
To answer your first question, then, it's vested interests. Stop. You know, there's so much crony capitalism in 21st century Britain, and everyone's got some government contract or this, and they all rely on government subsidy and government funding. And there is too much economic intervention. And, you know, I'm sure if a leader came along and said, I am standing for lower taxes, if you vote for me, you will pay lower taxes, you know, he might get a lot of votes. But the reality is, we have a two-party system, and for all the genius and admirable qualities of Nigel Farage, you know, he couldn't get rid of the two-party system.
He wasn't obviously in favour of much lower taxes either.
Well,
he's
a libertarian, basically. But we thought Brexit would end the two-party system, or many of us did, but it didn't. We've still got the Tories. We've still got Labour. Labour, you'd think the Tories would be a low-tax thing, but they're just another. You just see with everything that's going on, all the public infrastructure programmes that are being promised, the NHS and all the rest of it, they're just another, you know, left of centre social democracy. They call themselves Conservatives, but they seem to be anything but. And you talk to some of the sort of libertarians within the Conservative Party who perhaps think like you and me do, and they just say that there's nothing we can do. The rest of the party doesn't get it. And so I think it's partly an education thing. Now, one of the beauties of the internet is that there's just so many better informed people. And so, you know, just by talking, writing books, doing podcasts, getting the word out, more and more people will understand. But I sometimes think you need to just drop a bomb on the whole government and, you know, or find a new country and start again. It's really hard to reform what we already have, because it's just entrenched.
And is it that old adage, if you rob Peter to pay Paul, you can at least be sure of Paul's vote, right?
Yeah.
So that's sort of how the sort of trading works in the electoral game.
Absolutely, yeah. George Bernard Shaw said that. Any government voting, promising to rob Peter to pay Paul can pretty much count on the vote of Paul.
Yeah, so maybe that's the way they build their coalition. I want to finish by asking what your prescription is, because you don't advocate some sort of anarcho-capitalist zero tax world. You come up with an alternative basis, really, an alternative principle on which we could raise tax based around land usage. Talk us through that. If you were Chancellor of the Exchequer and you weren't bound in by any immediate electoral concerns or party political concerns, what would you write in the budget on March 11th?
I call that the final chapter of the book Designing Utopia, and I use the word utopia for a very good reason, in that it's never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay.
There's politics is the art of the possible. And I advocate, Hong Kong, 40% of government revenue came from land value tax, and I advocate the old single tax of Henry George, where the idea is, the basic principle is that the land belongs to everyone. But any value that the land has is given to us by nature. Now, any value that you create by building on the land should be yours to keep. The land itself was there and should be shared by all. And so I advocate, Australians call it unimproved. You have to value the land in its unimproved state.
Sure.
And obviously land in a city centre, on the Duke of Westminster's Grosvenor estate, is going to be extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Harrods or whatever.
Yep.
And land in, you know, the middle of Cornwall is going to have no value at all. Unless suddenly somebody strikes gold or there's a functioning tin mine.
Well, it's a tourist site. Cornwall's more...
But central Cornwall is...
Land values and then the moral basis of this is that this would belong to everybody, but you've now kind of, if you like, confiscated it into private hands. You've put a fence around it, and only you are now able, or people you invite into your private abode, are able to enjoy your back garden or whatever it might be. And given that you are therefore preventing the rest of humanity accessing these natural resources, you should pay a fine, a penalty, a reflection of compensation to that end.
Yeah, if you want the government to protect your title to that property, then, a rent needs to be paid to the community. And then the big issue is, how much is that rent?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that depends on how much government you want. If you want a government that provides everything, like the Soviet Union did, then that rent will be very high. If you want a minimum government that does very little, then that rent will be very low. And you know, the beauty of the land value tax is it's totally transparent and the amount of tax paid is directly felt. But on a practical basis, and the other thing I should say about the land value tax is people think it's going to hit farmers. It won't. It will hit those that own prime city centre real estate. Now, if you take a company like Google, Google pays very little tax because it's very clever and it's globalised and it puts this operation in Ireland and this operation there, and it reinvests its profits so that it doesn't have any profit and blah, blah, blah. All fair enough. But it is... You don't tax Google on its profit or anything like that. You tax Google on the land that it uses. So Google currently occupies vast swathes of very desirable real estate in King's Cross. Mm-hmm. And Google should just pay a tax based on the amount of the land that it uses, because that land in King's Cross only has value because the needs of the community have given it value. Similarly, Google's data centres will probably be located, in remote locations, but nevertheless it is still using land, so Google would pay a rent on the land that it uses for its data centers. So it stops all the... it's a very hard tax to avoid.
Yeah, it's not only sort of transparent, it's pretty clear who owns which chunk of land, right? Whereas what you're earning or how many cigarettes you smoke or how many boxes of tissues or television sets you've bought, I mean, that opens itself up to dodging and black market or grey market activity.
Of course it does. It's a very hard tax to avoid. It's a transparent tax. So on the one hand, it enables government to hold its taxpayers to account. But on the other hand, it enables taxpayers to hold its government to account, because they can go, hang on a minute, you're spending too much money here because mm-hmm. you're collecting more rent than we agreed in the election. So it works both ways. So it's quite healthy. Now, Henry George called it the single tax. And the idea was that there would be land value tax and nothing else.
Yeah.
No income tax, mm-hmm. no VAT. And the amount of land you use is up to you. If you don't want to pay a high amount of tax, then don't use very much land. So from that point of view, it's a beautiful thing. But what's going to happen is, the Tories are even talking about land value tax, is they're going to do it in addition to other taxes. And that way, hell lies. That is crony capitalist damnation. And of course, I don't have a problem with the royal family, but the Queen owns 1/6 of the world's land surface. Now, does the Crown really need... isn't that an extraordinary number? Mm-hmm. 1/6. Does it really need all that land? Could that land not be put to more useful? And in the UK, she owns vast swathes of the UK. Now, I'm not advocating getting rid of the Crown or anything else, but if the Crown paid a tax to the community based on the value of the amount of land it uses, it might either force the Crown to let go of some of that land, in which case other people could
develop it. Or use it more efficiently.
Yeah. And all that. So, but what will happen is they're going to introduce some kind of mansion tax, and it's going to hit middle-class people in Fulham, and the Queen's going to get off.
Right.
So, which is a bastardised
version. So although you've got this plan, you're not very optimistic about how tax is going to go. So
there's always too much compromise in politics. It needs an authoritarian.
We need a strong leader. You're going to
need an authoritarian libertarian.
So what should we be trying to do then? If we can't, I mean, I'm quite attracted to land value tax
in principle.
But I agree with you, when we're imposing more taxes, I very much think this should be true of climate change taxes as well. They should be an alternative way to tax things, not an additional way to tax things, right?
By the way, land value tax could apply to the airspace, to the bandwidth, all the things, that make, just not just land, water.
So natural resources, basically.
Yeah, anything that nature gave us.
But if you readily concede that your designing utopia chapter is unlikely to become UK government policy anytime imminently. So leave us with your thought about what we can do, even if we can't get to some perfect taxation system in the next few weeks, months or years. What do folk like you and I need to do in order to at least make the tax system less malign and oppressive and inefficient compared to what it presently is as we speak today in 2020?
Well, the thing I would like to do more than anything else is for our new Chancellor, and even more so Dominic Cummings, to read my book. If I could somehow get my book to Dominic Cummings, you know, because I, you know, you hear all these things about him, but I think he kind of gets it. And I think he would see, ah, actually, tax is how we can actually affect change. But in the UK in particular, we have the longest tax code in the world. It's 21,000 pages. It's 10 million words. And I can promise you that is more words than most people read in their entire life. And it's not like it's, you know, I think it's something like 14 times the length of the Bible. Now, it's not like, you know, Harry Potter or something. It's not like it's really...
It's not easy reading.
It's not a page turner.
It's impenetrable.
But one of the problem with complexity is it creates inequality because one group have the resources to find the loopholes and exploit them and the other doesn't. And so, you know... There should be fewer taxes, simpler taxes, and flatter taxes.
So, do you think we should strive to rewrite the tax code? Let's just, you know, can't do it overnight, but let's say now we're not going to keep these 21,000, 22,000 pages. We are going to write it all from scratch. Yeah, and whatever we write from scratch will start to apply from, I don't know, the 1st of January 2025 or
something like that. But there was a real golden opportunity for this government, strong majority, the favour of the people to do that. And you just look at every choice they've made, or pretty much every choice they've made so far, from my opinion, has been the wrong choice. And you just think, oh, it's just another... You get this after elections, you think, finally, a chance for change. And then they just go back to doing all the same stuff that the previous lot did. And, you know, we have this, you know, Sajid showed quite a lot of strength, I thought, to go, actually, if I can't have my people, I'm standing down. So we got this new guy in who's being advised by all Boris's or Cummings people, whatever. But he's obviously a clever guy, you know, he's head boy at school, and he worked for Goldman Sachs, his PPE at Oxford.
Supports Southampton Football Club.
Oh, does he? Even more enlightened. But, you know, you kind of get the impression, I don't want to do him wrong because I don't know, but you get the impression he's got where he is by saying yes to the right people. And so you can't see this guy being another Lawson who, I'm going to lose, get rid of one tax with every budget. That was the last chancellor we had who was seriously committed to tax simplification. You get the impression, particularly early on, he's not going to make any waves and just do what he's told.
But you certainly can't say of Dominic Cummings that he's got to where he is by saying yes to the right people.
No, but who is in charge? Is Boris in charge? Is Cummings in charge? I don't know. You might know better than me.
Well, I mean, I always think that it's very difficult to work out in these bureaucratic structures exactly who's in charge, because they're sort of, you know, it's like trying to work out who's got what pot of power in the Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty arbitrary in some ways. Obviously, the Prime Minister is ultimately in charge. He can sack Dominic Cummings. Dominic Cummings cannot sack the Prime Minister.
But he's not a detail guy, is he?
No, but I'm not sure you want the Prime Minister to be a detail guy, do you?
No, I think it goes on instinct. But I remember going to a Spectator event maybe it was a Telegraph event over at Methodist Hall. It was Q&A with Boris and Charles Moore. And at the end of the Q&A, and this is before Boris was PM, it was while Brexit was still ongoing. And at the end, we stood up and asked questions. And I stood up and asked a question. And the question I said is, what are you going to do? What can be done, Boris, to put the Conservative MPs, and remember this is the time of Dominic Grieve and everything else, there's this disconnect between what members of the Conservative Party want and what Conservative MPs actually want. And how can we get to a point where Conservative MPs start doing what the Conservative membership actually wants? Now, it's always the case that the membership is slightly more extreme than the MPs. And Boris's answer was, oh, yeah, well, if you look at kids, they're really libertarian. We've got to get with the kids. And you were like, oh, come on, Boris. Mm-hmm. That is just not a good enough answer. And I just wonder... You know, he wrote pretty classical liberally stuff in his column, but you wonder how ideologically committed he actually is.
Well, we're going to find out. The book is called Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future. Dominic, thank you for joining us to give us an overview of all of your thinking of tax through the ages and the tax problem and conundrum that faces us today. Thank you for your honesty in believing that you probably won't successfully design utopia in the next few weeks. But Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, Dominic Cummings, are you listening to this IEA podcast? If not, why not? You should be listening, and I strongly commend Dominic's book to you. Give it a read, and then perhaps start edging us in a more sensible direction as far as tax policy is concerned. Dominic, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.